There cannot be any more promising location for the deliberations of the powerful. Delphi, on the slopes of Mount Parnassus, was believed by the ancient Greeks to be the centre of the world. In spring, they would pack their togas and schlep up to Delphi to ponder the prophecies of the Pythia, the high priestess of the Temple of Apollo, also known as the Delphic Oracle. Delegates to the modern-day Delphi Economic Forum have it a bit easier. It's only a two-hour drive from Athens Airport, and the counsel on offer is somewhat more reliable than the maddeningly ambiguous ravings of a hallucinating witch. Since its establishment in 2016, the Delphi Economic Forum has become a crucial symposium for the discussion of a frequently fraught neighbourhood. Balkans to the north, Mediterranean to the south, Turkey to the east. The Foreign Desk was at Delphi this year and, between admiring the views down the hill to the Gulf of Itaea, consulted with a variety of eminent sages, some in the conference venues, some in the surrounding gardens, if you're wondering what the birdsong is about. This special episode compiles some of the highlights. How is Greece positioning itself as a recovering regional power? What can the president of a Balkan republic do to calm regional tensions? And is everyone still paying sufficient attention to Ukraine? This is the Foreign Desk.
In today's world, when we have 55 armed conflicts currently going on around the world, which is the highest number in the last 100 years, the United Nations is not doing its job. I think that we should try and work harder on the reform of the United Nations.
There is a long tradition of very intense and very, very positive Greek-German relations. And what we've seen recently, the financial crisis, especially 10 years ago, I think now receives a reappreciation.
We have gone through a period when we have not been talking to each other. And that is tragically wrong, and it is actually extremely dangerous. So I think that what we need to do is to agree to disagree and move on and make sure that we can actually live not necessarily together but necessarily side by side.
You're listening to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. The first guest on our Delphi Economic Forum special is Natasha Pierce-Musar, President of the Republic of Slovenia, who we last spoke to near the very beginning of her term. I began by asking her what she'd learned about the job since arriving in office.
I have to be honest, I have learned a lot. And I am greatly thankful to my team, all the colleague presidents around the world, because I am that kind of a person who likes grabbing the knowledge. I am every single day aware of the fact that I do not know everything. No person on the world knows everything. I think that Aristotle was the last one who they said that he knew everything.
Yeah? It's a bit of an occupational hazard among people in your job to think they do know everything,
oh,
though.
That's a danger ground. I was not aware of many things when I decided to run for a president. I didn't know there would be so much work at home, dealing with internal politics, going to many events, listening to the people. Sometimes I say that I would have to clone myself to be, you know, present at many events. Regarding the international politics, realpolitik is something that I don't want to just take into account. I think that there should be more leaders to discuss that something has to be done. I would not want to put myself into a position that nothing can be done. Especially, I sense this attitude, this approach in smaller countries. But, you know, inside the United Nations, which is the only multilateral fora that we do have and we have to nurture it, every single vote counts. And now, when Slovenia is a non-permanent member of the Security Council, we have to be vocal about many things and we have to try and do good for all the nations, not just European Union. And this is what we were saying when we were lobbying for the seat at the Security Council, that we are not going to be a subsidy of European Union or Europe, so we have to listen to the whole world. And I think that Slovenia is doing that. And I am greatly thankful to the team in New York and to all the diplomats. And I wish And I think we will continue to do so in the next year and a half, for sure.
Do you not think, though, that this has been the last couple of years, if for extremely grim reasons, kind of a moment for smaller countries? The Baltic states in particular have been driving the discussion on how Europe should respond to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Do you draw an amount of encouragement and even courage from them?
I am closely following what the Baltic states are saying. Of course, we are discussing the war in Ukraine because the Baltic states know the bad side of the Russian soul because of the Soviet Union empire that they were part of for many decades. And you can see that the Baltic states are really, really vocal inside the European Union. They are constantly reminding us that we have to stay unified. And listening to Baltic states, I think this is the main message. If European Union is going to stay unified, we will be stronger. It's not an easy task, because to make 27 member states unified in every single topic, it's a hard job. But we have to strive and work towards that path, because if we are not unified, Europe is not going to be the power that we want Europe to be.
I mean, they did look briefly as if there was a period at which those countries were unified, possibly absent Hungary and maybe Poland at the time.
And now Slovakia.
Well, I did want to ask, what is your view on why in a few Eastern European countries that you might think would know better, Slovakia being one of them, Hungary, Serbia, Republika Srpska, which I know is not a country entire, even though its present government might wish it was. Where does that enduring, I guess, sort of sentimental fondness for Russia come from?
We have to understand the past. Okay, regarding Serbia, they are the Orthodox brothers. You have to understand that part. Regarding the ex-Yugoslavian republics, we have to understand the history as well, because, you know, in 1948, when Tito had a fight with Stalin, so we were not a member of the Warsaw Pact, the history in this region was different than inside the countries which were part of the Soviet Union Empire at that time. So this is the difference between the Baltic countries and Western Balkan, for example. What I do miss in the debates regarding Russia and Ukraine, I think that we are not discussing peace enough. We are supporting Ukraine. Every single day, Slovenia is supporting Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Why? The fact is that we do know who the aggressor was. Being a lawyer, if somebody is violating the international law, that's the worst thing the country and the leaders of such countries can do for the international peace and security. And what I am watching in United Nations currently, it hurts me really badly, because United Nations were supposed to be the beacon of peace and security, and they were for many years. When I was a young girl, I remember whenever there was a conflict somewhere, the blue helmets came there, ceasefire, let's discuss. But in today's world, when we have 55 armed conflicts currently going on around the world, which is the highest number in the last 100 years, the United Nations is not doing its job. Whose fault is this? There are many factors, but I think that we should try and work harder on the reform of the United Nations.
Do you mean the Security Council in particular?
Of course, everything is in the hands of the Security Council. General Assembly can only give non-binding opinions, so that's also a problem. But today, when veto power is abused on a daily basis, I think that the discussions which are held for 25 years already should be boosted. And my idea is that we have to go step by step. The first step, if I may just take a couple of minutes to explain. The first step was in September 2021, when the so-called Liechtenstein Initiative was adopted at the General Assembly. And this initiative was saying, and is saying, that every single country which is using veto at the Security Council, they need to explain why they use it at the General Assembly. So that was adopted. But of course, those are soft powers. Next step, which is debated inside the United Nations, is that the veto must not be used when mass atrocities are in question. So that's the next step. It's a hard one already.
Because you're going to get disagreement on what actually is an atrocity.
And the veto power countries, the P5, are going to hesitate. They always do hesitate to give the veto powers away.
And they will want to protect their own power.
Sure. The third step, which is the most important one if you ask me, and it's going to be hard as well, close to impossible, I think, is that the countries which are debated at the Security Council should not have the right to vote. And this goes for non-permanent or permanent members. So there is a lot on the table. Maybe we are not vocal enough about what's needed to be done, but I try to be.
That one is going to be a tough sell, obviously. I did want to ask, though, about, well, not conflict, but near conflict closer to home, and whether you're concerned that not enough attention is being paid to the danger of the Western Balkans. We have seen Kosovo and Serbia go quite close a number of times in the last couple of years. You did speak last year of wanting to encourage dialogue between President Vucic and Prime Minister Kurti. Is there a role, do you think, that other countries that used to be part of Yugoslavia could be playing between Kosovo and Serbia, or at least a more active intermediary role?
Definitely, because, you know, being part of Yugoslavia for 75 years, we know the mentality, we know the culture, we know, you know, the reasoning behind in politics. The Balkan politics is specific. You have to go into the fundamentals to understand what's going on. And in the first year of my mandate, I really did try and visit nearly every Western Balkan country. I was really well accepted in all those countries. You know, I talk their language, so it's one barrier is stepped over. Language could be sometimes a barrier, lost in translation. You hear this sentence many times. And regarding Serbia and Kosovo, I am sad to see that the talks were put on hold. You know, they were so close to the agreement what to do. President Vucic and Prime Minister Kurti agreed on all the points, but they didn't sign the new agreement at the end. From my point of view, I would say that the most important part of the cohabitation between Serbia and Kosovo is to admit that minorities do have rights. Being a lawyer and being a human rights lawyer, I will say this sentence many times. I do believe that the law is always a part of solution. And once the legal ground is on the table and you know that you have to obey what you have signed, and then you break the agreement, that's the worst thing it can happen. And this is not okay. You know, the agreement for the northern part of Kosovo, where Serbian minority lives, was signed in 2013 already, and it is still not respected. I am not going to blame anybody, because either Serbia or Kosovo, I think they are just not trying enough to find a solution. But I will try, and I will have a deep discussion with President Vjosa Osmani in a couple of days, and I want to hear, you know, all the details, so to get a bigger picture. And being an optimist for the whole of my life, there is one point I always have in my mind. If you stop the dialogue and if you stop the discussions, the solutions are not going to be there. If you do continue to talk to each other, there might be a solution at the end. If you are not talking to each other, there is no solution. But that's the basics of politics.
Does finding solutions like that, though, become more difficult in the current media landscape? And this is a question going back to your time as Information Commissioner, and I know it's something you've thought about a lot and written about a lot. But the difficulty of conducting negotiations or conversations which are this delicate and are so tied up in history and culture and national psyches, amid this ceaseless clamour on social media, often amplified by disinformation and misinformation, should it not be possible to hold them to the same standards as any publisher? Pass laws suggesting or enforcing that anything that gets published on your, under your masthead, you are responsible for it in the way that a newspaper is. Because they try to pitch themselves as completely neutral conduits.
Yeah, but they are not.
Which they're obviously not.
No, they are not. We were all seeing a change when Elon Musk was taking over Twitter, now X. You know, the policy behind changed drastically. And I think that to use a soft law approach so that they should self-regulate themselves, that's a good approach. But if it doesn't work, then we have to do something else. The problem with the social media networks and the internet is that we still do not have the global law of the net. If we regulate this in Europe and in European Union, we are the champions in regulating high tech. You know, data protection was one of them. Now the Artificial Intelligence Act is already adopted. So we are trying to do this, but without the global law of the net, I don't know whether we will find a solution. Maybe there is a parallel, you know, when we were discussing the law of the open sea, the international lawyers were discussing this for 20 years. And okay, at the end we got some law, and we have pirates at the open sea, we have pirates on the internet, so there are a lot of parallels. And I think that the future should go into regulation, not too heavy, because freedom of expression is a very strong human right. Mm-hmm. Freedom of expression is the heart and soul of every single democracy. So we have to be careful, cautious, so with a shaky hand to sign such regulations. But the problem we are discussing here today is that the social networks are not letting the researchers, the AI tools to fight disinformation into their back system. They are allowing only to supervise in a way, 3% of all the content. You have to pay for this 3%, which is, you know, not a high amount of money, but still, the rest of 97% is just there. So to fight disinformation, we should focus primarily now to the institutionalized media, the web portals. This is where the news is also produced widely. Social networks are still a bit of a puzzle, I agree.
That was Natasha Pirc-Musar, President of the Republic of Slovenia, speaking to us at the Delphi Economic Forum. You're listening to The Foreign Desk. This is The Foreign Desk on Monocle Radio. As recently as 10 years ago, there would have been few more challenging diplomatic postings in Europe than Germany's ambassador to Greece. As Greece struggled to meet its obligations during and after the Eurozone crisis, it was Germany who played the role, with what some felt was untoward relish, of the bailiff beating on the door, threatening to take the television. Our next guest is Andreas Kindl, Germany's ambassador to Greece since last year. I began by asking him what Germany's relationship with Greece is like today, given that it has had, in the past, its moments.
I agree. We've had some dark patches, if you want. And just in time, last weekend, the autobiography of Wolfgang Schäuble was published, mm-hmm. There was some feedback here. Parts of it were translated into Greek in some of the newspapers, and you could have some feedback from people who were involved at the time, and it is interesting to see that I started reading it on Monday, and I think that it will be able to clarify if you read it, and I only recommend it to a Greek audience to read the whole book and not just the 40 so pages concerned with the Greek financial crisis. It will bring a different light on Wolfgang Schäuble, and I realize that this is already happening when I talk to central bank governor or bankers who, with hindsight, see that what happened 10 years ago was A, not only a bilateral issue between Germany and Greece, and B, rather helpful, in fact, for overcoming a massive crisis that involved not just Greece, but obviously several other countries in the European Union and in the Eurozone, and before that the US, and basically globally. So from that starting point, I would say that the Greek-German relationship has been a very long relationship. Mm. You know, it comes from the first king, if you want, who was a Bavarian in the beginning of the 19th century, the largest number of Philhellenes in the independence fights was German. The orange trees you see in Athens now have been planted by the German queen, the wife of the king. So there is a long tradition of very intense and very, very positive Greek-German relations. And what we've seen recently, the financial crisis, especially in the last 10 years ago, I think now receives a reappreciation, and it will be seen that, of course, Wolfgang Schäuble was a tough negotiator. Mm. He was a tough finance minister and member of the Eurozone group. But if you read the book, you will see that he had a natural warmth for Greece. And he did whatever he could to maximize the positive effects on Greece. And I'm sure this will be seen if it's been read.
Do you feel like there is still work to do, though? Because recent polls, and I'm sure you've seen them, suggest that Greeks do remember these events of not so long ago. There was a perception at the time that, rightly or wrongly, that Germany was rather hanging Greece out of a window by its ankles until it got with the programme. And polls suggest that a majority of Greeks do still have a broadly negative opinion of Germany, doubtless attached to that. In your role, what do you feel like you can do to overcome that?
Absolutely. I mean, there is an there's a potential, a high potential, I would say, for improvement of these perceptions. We have almost 5 million German tourists a year in Greece. They spend slightly over average of the tourists. So there's a very dense personal relationship of 5 million people coming here, and a lot of them actually living here. So there is a high potential for mingling, coming together, and you notice that people speak German, especially in the tourism sector and traditionally also in northern Greece. So one element is, I think, a natural element of people coming together. We have long-standing institutions that facilitate this renewal, if you want, or coming together of two countries. We have the German Archaeological Institute, 150 years anniversary, the Chamber of Commerce, 100 years, and so on. And we have this year the opportunity, being the honorary country at the Thessaloniki International Fair in September. So I think this is a very good opportunity for this year to promote the idea that Greek-German relations, depicted in the polls you mentioned, with a unbelievably, horribly low positive number, can be improved and will be improved. So this is, I think, a good start.
Do you think there's maybe a diplomatic opportunity almost in the fact that Greece and Germany are, I think it's fair to say, on the same side of one issue, which is that of cross-Mediterranean immigration? Greece is often an arrival point, and Germany is very often the place those people are hoping to go.
Yeah, we have a very close cooperation on migration matters, exactly for the reasons you mentioned, that Greece is a, if you want, frontier state. Mm. This is the arrival state, and Germany rather naturally is the state where all those people who arrive in Greece after, you know, finalizing their procedures and so on, move on to Germany. And obviously this ties us together in bilateral issues, but also as partners in the endeavor to unify asylum legislation in the European Union. And we just were successful in, after 8 years of preparation, to have this done with the parliamentary decision yesterday. So yes, obviously this is one subject we have very close cooperation. We've had a delegation from the Ministry of Interior here recently. We have a half-yearly migration dialogue with Greece, so the cooperation there is very, very intense, and obviously we are natural partners in this. It's interesting for us to see how the perception and the policy in Greece is moving from a more traditional way of seeing migrants, illegal migrants, as a problem, towards seeing the opportunities and the advantages of migration for the national and local labour market.
Just finally, I was wondering if you see at any level German commerce and German trade as a diplomatic lever. I know Kyriakos Mitsotakis, the Prime Minister, when he visited Berlin in November, said German companies were now the leading foreign investors in Greece. I guess as a symbol of that, we see Greece and Volkswagen working together to try and turn one island into a sustainability hub. I guess is the question is, do you, as ambassador, hope that Germany can eventually trade its way back into Greece's high opinion?
That's an interesting fact, that during all the crisis, German companies have not left Greece. Mm. There are roughly, I think, 150 German companies, and they employ between 25 and 30,000 people in Greece. And we have been among importers, exporters always number one, number two, and investors also very high up, depending on how you calculate, whether you calculate tourism or real estate or financing of funds. But if you look at real investment by companies, I think we're very high up, much higher than other countries who play a bigger role in the newspapers. I'm just saying so. We have big investments from companies, and we've had them all the time. I think this is almost independent of the perception of Germany in the Greek public, in Greece, but they're doing a good job, German companies, and they are evolving. I mean, I could go to, every week I could go to a opening of a German company or a launch of their Greek business. So a lot is happening, and as I said earlier with the Thessaloniki International Fair, this is a moment where we have more than 100 partners coming, more than 100 presenters of their activities, much more than we expected. I think it gives an idea of what German companies see in Greece, and that they feel that there's a strong trend, an upward trend, and that it's worthwhile looking at the opportunities they have in this country.
That was Andreas Kindl, Germany's ambassador to Greece. You're listening to The Foreign Desk. This is the Foreign Desk's Delphi Economic Forum special with me, Andrew Muller. Our next guest is Yulia Klimenko, Ukrainian Member of Parliament and First Deputy Chair of the Ukrainian Parliament's Committee on Transport and Infrastructure. I began by asking Yulia how optimistic she is still able to be about the outcome of Ukraine's war with Russia.
I am optimistic, and I can tell you why, because I understand that we have a very big army, a very well-trained army. It's more than 900,000 people, and we just 30 minutes ago passed updated legislation on mobilization, so we will mobilize another 200,000 to 300,000 people. So in total, it will be 1.2 million army, which is the biggest in Europe, and not only in Europe, probably in the world. After the China and Russia. But the optimism is very spoiled by the absence of the weapon, mm-hmm. because we will have enough manpower, but without weapon it's very difficult to defend, particularly critical infrastructure inside the country, and particularly civilians, because we need a lot of air defense systems to cover critical infrastructure and to protect civilians. Unfortunately, it's a lack of air defense systems and a lack of munition on the front line, which is, I mean, the sad part of this story, because unfortunately we have 10 years of war and 2 years of the full-scale invasion, and we still, I mean, many countries thinking it will somehow be solved without munition, and that's why industrial lines are cold in Europe and in the US. So we are producing what we can. We can produce drones, we can produce some mines, we can produce some rounds, but it's still, we need much more. And we cannot produce fully on the territory of Ukraine because it's hit it all the time by Russian missiles. So it's a very unsafe situation to produce weapon inside the country. So we need at least to have it outside Ukraine.
We have, of course, though, nevertheless, heard recent remarks by French President Emmanuel Macron, echoed to an extent by Polish Foreign Minister Radek Sikorski, that they wouldn't necessarily rule out the prospect that foreign troops might be deployed to Ukraine to help defend Ukraine. How did it feel hearing that even being discussed? Was that reassuring to you, or do you still kind of feel like we can actually do this ourselves if we're just properly equipped?
You know, I don't think that European troops would be very efficient on Ukrainian battlefield, honestly. Forgive me. Because I think the last time Europeans fought, it was 70 years ago. And it's 3 generations in peace and in training centers, which is completely different from barbarian war we have in between Ukraine and Russia. And it's a type of World War I. You have to be prepared morally and physically to fight such war. And I don't think European troops are ready to fight this kind of war. That's why I'm saying if Putin will invade Europe, I'm not sure that Europe will sustain for a long period of time.
You're quite right to point out that Ukraine is going through a pretty singular experience in the context of Europe's recent history. And I just wonder if you ever allow yourself to think beyond this conflict, which obviously we all hope ends sooner rather than later. But do you think out the other side of this, Ukraine will be a much different country, even from the one that elected you in 2019?
Yeah, I think it will be a completely different country because of the completely different demographic. Because people, I don't believe that 6 million people who left Ukraine will come back, unfortunately, because war is long period of time, 3-5 years. People will have their new lives. Kids will grow in different countries with different languages, with different school systems. It's very difficult to come back. Then you will have a lot of veterans. It's a completely different situation when you have 1.2 million of veterans in the country. And this is completely different policies and political discussions. Then you will have to militarize basically Ukraine because you will need to protect against Russia all the time. So Russia will not disappear tomorrow, unfortunately. And we have these 2,000 kilometers borders and we need to protect it even after our victory. So that's why we need de facto Israel model where we can protect ourselves at any point of time or join NATO and then to help NATO to protect European territories. It will change social part of Ukraine as well as economic part because we will need to revise our migration policies, how to invite people to work on reconstruction, on farmers, etc., etc. If 6 million people left, then we need to replace people and labor force. How we will deal with the labor force? How we will deal in a long-term perspective? What will be our competitive advantage? And how we will protect ourselves inside NATO or outside NATO, that will completely shape all economic, social policies.
Just finally then, an extension of that question at a more metaphysical level, I guess. We've heard from a lot of the Ukrainians we've spoken to over the last couple of years that if Ukraine was perhaps a divided, fractured, uncertain country with no real sense of national character 2 years ago, it sure as hell has a sense of national character now. Do you feel like is the spiritual the adjective I'm looking for? At that level, Ukraine has changed. Has the idea of Ukrainian identity changed as you see it?
I would say we had a strong identity. I do not agree that we didn't have identity. We always had a strong identity. The problem is we need all the time dignity. So we are fighting for freedom and dignity with a nation who has fighting for many centuries for our freedom and dignity. And this level of dignity, unfortunately, was very low before the full-scale invasion. So Ukrainians need to believe in themselves. Right. And that's our heroic and bloody contribution, make us stronger. We do believe in ourselves that we can make the difference, not only in our country, but outside our country. So it's anyhow, in the history, Ukrainians will be a brave nation.
That was Yulia Klemenko speaking to us on the Foreign Desk on Monocle Radio. This is the Foreign Desk's Delphi Economic Forum special on Monocle Radio. Our final guest is Maria Gavunelli, Director of the Hellenic Foundation for European and Foreign Policy, also known as ELIAMEP. I began by asking her whether Greece has a newfound confidence in the foreign policy realm compared to the depths of the Eurozone debt crisis.
I certainly hope so. I mean, we have gone through these very traumatic crises. Traumatic simply because for people of my generation who were born and bred European, to suddenly find ourselves at the brink of collapse with a bankruptcy in our hands, that was really the major trauma of our lives. So yes, the fact that we can actually stand up on our two feet and we're doing better, we're not necessarily doing great, but we're doing certainly better. So that is important. And that shows. That shows in the confidence that we have, that shows in the projection of Greece all over the place. We have gone through some very dark days. We try to forget them. I hope that we do not forget them too quickly, but we would certainly be ready for a better situation. The risk nowadays is perhaps a question of high expectations, how we can manage not to be too confident, but rather realize that, okay, we're doing better, but there is still risk. There's still quite a lot of work that needs to be done.
I mean, that's obviously a much more preferable bunch of problems to have. And the person, I guess, who has to address them is the current Prime Minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis.
Clearly.
Do you get a sense of how ambitious he is as a foreign policy Prime Minister?
Well, I think that I get the sense, to be more specific, that if they manage to come up with a major breakthrough, for instance, in our relationship with Turkey, they would consider that as part of their legacy. And that would indeed be something very, very important indeed. On the other hand, they have already done quite a lot of things. For instance, in terms of law of the sea, for instance. Mm-hmm. My morning job, as I always say, is professor of international law at the University of Athens, and this is my specialty. Greece has been a very active participant in the negotiations for the Law of the Sea Convention 50 years ago. And then suddenly we rested on our laurels, and that was that. And it was only very recently, under the current government, that we were able to actually implement properly the provisions of the Law of the Sea Convention and therefore have an EEZ in this country. And that's important. We have started talking about energy corridors at sea. We have been talking just about protected areas. Do you know for how long we have been talking about these protected areas?
I'm guessing a while.
Decades? So suddenly you see things happening, and that is important.
The particular foreign policy challenge you mentioned, the relationship with Turkey, which I guess is the first thing that anybody who arrives in power in Greece starts thinking about, what's the actual optimum outcome there? How good can that relationship ever get? Is it imaginable that, for example, Greece and Turkey would get along at least as well as, I don't know, France and Germany do now?
Oh, I wish. I sincerely don't believe that that will be the case in my lifetime, to be absolutely and brutally frank. However, we have gone through a period when we have not been talking to each other. And that is tragically wrong, and it is actually extremely dangerous. So I think that what we need to do is to agree to disagree and move on, and make sure that we can actually live, not necessarily together, but necessarily side by side. We are condemned by geography and history, and we have to make do. I had a colleague, a Turkish colleague, telling me some time ago that, but why should we have this botheration between ourselves? We were all parts of the same empire. And I was just looking at him. I said, you know, if that's the way you approach things, perhaps we need to restart our discussion, isn't it? Because that really is telling, isn't it?
But is it conceivably one of those things? And perhaps the better question is, does Kyriakos Mitsotakis see it as one of those things where a personal relationship can make a difference? He's going to Ankara fairly shortly. Is it a relationship that could conceivably be reset just by whether or not Mitsotakis and President Erdogan are those two people, but by having the right two people in those positions at the same time?
Well, the right two people in terms of functional cooperation, I would argue. I don't think that's a question of personal chemistry. In fact, I would suggest that there is no personal chemistry. There's nothing common between those two people. But if we can actually move ahead and just work together, I think that would be important. What is equally important, and I think this is something that we somehow forget in domestic politics, is that foreign policy is not just the bilateral issue with Turkey.
Sure.
And the fact that Greece nowadays is able actually to project itself beyond the bilateral issue, place itself in the wider Mediterranean, place itself in the southeastern European side and the Balkans and beyond Balkans, start talking about what is happening in corridors from Mimac to India and beyond, and shipping and the newly re-established corridor from Alexandroupolis to Constanza and then on to Ukraine and then to parts north. I think these are all very, very important issues. And of course, the ongoing cooperation with the US, which builds on a very old coalition and friendship that is also historical and cultural and all kinds of other things. So the fact that we are now again participating in this international debate, That by itself is extremely important.
Is there more that Greece could or should be doing, though, especially in terms of maritime security? You mentioned shipping, which is obviously tremendously important to Greece, and Greece controls, for a country of its relatively small size, an astonishingly disproportionate amount of global freight tonnage. Does Greece need to make more of an effort and make itself more prominent in protecting those shipping lanes? And we have seen, obviously, in recent months how vulnerable they can be, particularly turning left out of the Suez Canal.
Exactly. But you see, Greece was there. And this time around, Greece did not simply participate. They were actually heading the Operation Aspides off in the Red Sea. And the reason they have actually sought to do so was simply because we have to put our mouth where our money is. We are, in fact, one of the major players in international shipping. We might as well do something about the security of international shipping. It would have been inconceivable to do otherwise. Now, whether that is something that would cost us money, absolutely. Whether that is something that might actually overexert the Navy, for instance, that has gone through the crisis as well and has also other commitments in the Eastern Mediterranean, yes, and undoubtedly so. But that comes part and parcel of the whole idea of securing your economic lifeline at the end of the day. Who else is going to do that for us unless we do it ourselves?
I just want to end with a fairly broad question, but it just occurred to me that in the last 2 years in Eastern Europe especially, we have seen a lot of relatively small countries, one thinks of the Baltic states in particular, making themselves very much heard because of the extremely peculiar circumstances in Eastern Europe at the moment. I'm just wondering if you think if Greece still doesn't quite know its own strength as a diplomatic force. This is a country about which the whole world knows at least something, a country to which the whole world owes a great deal, obviously, and a country with an absolutely colossal diaspora. And I just wonder if Greece makes a slightly fundamental mistake in thinking of itself as a small country.
Oh, absolutely. I keep telling my students that they consider ourselves as being a very poor, small country. Mm. And I keep telling them that we are not that poor anymore. Even in the worst throes of the crisis, we were ranked 33rd in the UN index. So, you know, it's not exactly the poorest of the poor.
It's all relative.
So, again, we are a country that has been around in the European Union for 40 years. We were the 10th member. Mm-hmm. So we are an old hand, if you like. Yes, I understand. I have a feeling that we do not understand what is expected of us, because noblesse oblige. Huh? So if you are one of the oldest members, you might as well do something about it. On the other hand, yes, in the past decade or so, we were simply unable to do it, and we have to readjust both our finances but also our thinking around it. And of course, we have to be extra careful not to go above. Mm-hmm. Because overexerting ourselves at the situation where we stand, which is certainly better, but not out of the woods entirely, it is so easy to just overstep and lose that balanced approach. And I think for the time being, we're moving ahead. We need to work more on our diaspora. Our diaspora is precious. And that's why we do have a concerted effort in recent times to draw them back, not only to come physically back, but also to vote. So they might be wherever they are, but to the extent that they participate in national elections and, of course, in European elections, then immediately you are drawn back into the Greek community. And nowadays, diaspora is not really a physical presence, also a mental presence. Mm. So people can be in Brussels or Berlin or London or Paris or New York or Melbourne and still be there. So I think we need to tap on that. And of course, nobody can beat the brand name Greece. Absolutely nobody. There's no question about that. And I think we need to concentrate on that and move on. There's a tendency among Greeks. Throughout our very long history, we go for ups and downs. There's never a medium. So we are either the best in the world or the absolute worst in the world. The possibility that we might be something in between does not occur to us.
That was Maria Gavanelli from Eliamep speaking to us on the Foreign Desk. And that's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Chris Chermak and Christy O'Grady. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. To contact The Foreign Desk team, you can email Chris at cc@monocle.com. And don't forget to subscribe to Monocle Magazine and to our free daily email bulletins by heading to our website at monocle.com. From me, Andrew Muller, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.